told at the lowest level of initiative, moving up to ask, moving to make a recommendation, moving to I intend to, then moving to do it and report immediately, then moving to do it and report periodically, and finally, just do it, which is right at the center of your ability to control and influence. You choose which level of initiative to use based on how far the task lies within or without your circle of influence. This takes situational sensitivity and judgment, but little by little, your circle of influence will expand. Choosing our level of initiative widens our definition of voice, so that we can find our voice in any set of circumstances. It may be in a job that we don't enjoy at all. By exercising a level of initiative, we can change the nature of that job, or we can influence others that are in our circle of influence but outside our job. In our present job, we can strive for excellence. We can benchmark against world-class rather than national, regional, local standards. A lawyer could be more of a peacemaker. An educator could be more of a caring shepherd and coach and mentor. A doctor could focus more on education and prevention and deal with the whole person instead of just body parts, technology, and chemistry. A parent could strive to have 80% of all interactions positive, with only 20% involved with chastening, correcting, or disciplining. The salesperson could listen more for needs and adapt with integrity. The marketing person could guarantee the integrity of merchandising and advertising. The business executive would be careful to under-promise and over-deliver. In short, we can teach principles always and everywhere. And sometimes we may need to use words. Let's explore each of the levels of initiative. The first and lowest level of initiative. Wait until told. This would involve a concern that obviously lies outside of not only your circle of influence, but also your job. On this one, you just wait. You don't want to be doing someone else's job. You don't want to be making recommendations about things that are way outside of your circle of influence. People would not have confidence in your recommendation for a number of reasons. They would see your recommendation as being entirely inappropriate, and perhaps see you as being entirely out of line. Acting in areas far outside your circle of influence will actually cause your circle of influence to become smaller. So what do? You smile. Just like the serenity prayer used by Alcoholics Anonymous. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And wisdom to know the difference. You no longer waste your energy on something you can do nothing about. Now, if you have influence with someone who can do something about it, that's different. You can then move higher up the levels of initiative and self-empowerment. I know it's not easy to smile and do nothing about the issue for now, but many people obsess about stupid things that they can't change at the present times. They sit around and swap war stories with co-workers and massage one another's hearts about the things they can do nothing about. But you know, that just weakens their ability to make things happen on the issues and concerns that they can do something about. Again, their past holds their future hostage. People who don't have their own deep internal act together seek their security from sources outside themselves. Because they're codependent with their environment, they engage in these five destructive, cancerous behaviors: criticizing, complaining, comparing, competing, and contending. These five emotional cancers literally metastasize their cancerous cells into relationships, and sometimes throughout an entire organization. Then you've got an organization that's so polarized, so divided, that it's almost impossible to consistently deliver high quality to customers. One note on competing. Although competition for a sense of worth within relationships, families, and work teams and cultures is so damaging, I believe it can be very healthy in settings such as athletics and the marketplace. It can stretch and draw the best in people and organizations. In the marketplace, you can look upon your competitors as your teachers, against whom you can benchmark yourself, particularly if you have worldwide competition and world-class competition. While you may be trying to beat out your competitors, what you're really trying to do is to win better for your customers and to learn from those who are doing it better and faster than you are. That's the power of the free enterprise system. Competition inside the marketplace, cooperation inside the workplace. Remember, we must be bilingual and avoid the single-minded danger that Abraham Maslow described. He that is good with the hammer tends to think everything is a nail. Second level of initiative, ask. It would be reasonable and logical to ask a question about something within your job description, but it may still be outside your circle of influence. But because it's outside your circle of influence, you can't do much about it. But since it affects your job, most people would still consider it legitimate to at least ask. If the question is intelligent, and is the result of thorough analysis and careful thinking, it could be very impressive and may increase your circle of influence. Third level of initiative or self-empowerment, make a recommendation. Where would you put the make a recommendation? Consider again the two circles. The larger one is the circle of concern. The smaller inside one is the circle of influence. Where would you put make a recommendation? I'll think. You'd put it right at the outside edge of your circle of influence. It may not have anything to do with your job. Like in the illustration with those general agents in the insurance industry. You see, you're making a recommendation that is outside of your job and at the outside edge of your circle of influence. A beautiful illustration of the third level of initiative and self-empowerment is found in the military doctrine of completed staff work. The five basic steps of this doctrine are these. First, analyze the problem. Second, come up with alternative and recommended solutions. Third, develop recommended steps to execute the solution. Fourth, incorporate an awareness of all realities. Political, social, economic, competencies, etc. Fifth, make a recommendation in a way that only requires approval by a single signature. Completed staff work requires the effective executive to wait for the best work. First, she asks people to think through problems and issues. Then, when they have done their best thinking, they are to bring a final recommendation. She only looks at that final recommendation. When using completed staff work, upper-level management does not rescue people with quick and easy answers, even though they might plead for them. If the executive doesn't wait until the work is done, she cheats people of growth, and they cheat her and the organization of time. Moreover, people cannot be held responsible for results if they are given the methods. General George S. Patton once said, "Once in Sicily, I told a general who was somewhat reluctant to attack that I had perfect confidence in him. To show it, I went home." Never tell people what to do, and they will surprise you with their ingenuity. You can see how much time and work this saves the executive and how much more initiative it requires from the staff person. I've seen this work marvelously in many, many situations. It also immediately enlarges one circle of influence, just as it did with those insurance general agents. Fourth level of initiative or self-empowerment. We'll call this, I intend to. I intend to is actually one notch of initiative higher than making a recommendation, and is an extension of it. I first learned this principle while sailing in the Hawaiian Islands on the USS Santa Fe, a multi-billion-dollar nuclear submarine in simulated war games. What a magnificent sight it was to stand on the bridge with the commanding officer, Captain David Marquette, as we pulled out of the Lahaina seaport, and to see that massive black tube 100 yards in front of you, about the length of an American football field, and about 100 feet behind, plowing through the water. While the two of us were engaged in a conversation, an officer approached us and said, "Captain, I intend to take this boat down 400 feet. The captain asked, "What is the sounding?" In other words, the depth of the ocean floor. He said, "About 800. "What does the sonar say?" That is the electronic device that senses other ships, boats, subs, objects. The officer replied, "Nothing, only fish." The captain answered, "Give us another 20 minutes and then carry out your intention." Throughout the day, people would come up to the captain and say, "I intend to do this," or "I intend to do that." The captain would often ask questions and then say, "Very well." Sometimes he would ask no questions and simply reply, "Very well." The captain reserved only the tip of the iceberg type decisions for his own confirmation. The great mass of the iceberg, the other 95% of the decisions, were being made without any involvement or confirmation by the captain whatsoever. I asked the captain about his leadership style. He said that he wanted to empower his people as far as he possibly could within the confines of the naval context. He thought that if he required them to own not only the problem, but also the solution to the problem, they would begin to view themselves as a vitally important link in the chain of command. He matured the culture to the point where the officers and sailors declared their own intentions regarding the captain's decision authority. "I intend to" is different in kind than "I recommend." The person has done more analytical work to the point that he or she is totally prepared to carry out the action once it is improved. He or she has owned not only the problem, but the solution as well, and he or she is ready to implement it. These sailors had a real sense of adding value, something they indicated to me they had not had with other skippers, where they'd been merely in a wait-until-told mode. This is why "I intend to" is on the outside edge of one's circle of influence and of one's job. Meaningful empowerment significantly increases turnover. That is, losing top people to much higher paying and more satisfying work. Months after my subride, I was thrilled to receive a letter from Captain Marquette informing me that the USS Santa Fe was awarded the Admiral Burke Trophy for the most improved submarine, ship, or aviation squadron in the Pacific. Such is the fruit of trim-tabbing empowerment. Fifth level of initiative, or self-empowerment. Do it and report immediately. Do it and report immediately would be on the outside edge of one circle of influence, but within one's job. You report immediately because other people need to know. This enables others to see if everything was done correctly and to allow for timely corrections if necessary. It also provides information needed by others before they can make consequent decisions and take follow-up actions. Sixth level of initiative, do it and report periodically. This level of initiative pertains to actions that could be part of a normal self-evaluation in a performance evaluation visit or on a formal report so that the information can be communicated and used by others. When you report periodically, you find yourself clearly within your job description and within your circle of influence. The highest level of initiative and self-empowerment is simply to just do it. When something is right at the center of your circle of influence and the core of your job description, you just do it. Sometimes, in some cultures, it's easier to get forgiveness than to get permission. So if you're convinced you're right, and that the action is not that far outside your circle of influence, it may be best to do it. There is great power in the idea of taking responsibility and just doing it, making it happen. This highest level of initiative reminds me of a true story called A Message to Garcia, written by Elbert Hubbard. Here is a brief summary. When the war broke out between Spain and the United States at the turn of the century, the American president needed to get a message to a Cuban revolutionary named Garcia. He was hiding somewhere on the island of Cuba, out of reach of mail or telegraph. Nobody knew how to reach him, but an officer suggested that if anyone could do it, it would be an officer by the name of Rowan. When President McKinley gave the letter to Rowan in Washington, D.C., the officer didn't ask, "Where is he at? How do I get there? What do you want me to do when I'm there? How will I get back?" He just took the message and figured out how to get to Garcia. He took a train to New York, a ship to Jamaica, broke the Spanish blockade to get to Cuba in a sailboat, then wild carriage rides, marching and riding through the Cuban jungle. 9 days of traveling later, Rowan got the message to Garcia at 9 a.m. That same afternoon at 5, he started his return journey to the United States. Giving further insight, author Elbert Hubbard wrote, "My heart goes out to the man who does his work when his boss is away as well as when he is at home. The man who, when given a letter to Garcia, quietly takes the missive without asking any idiotic questions and with no lurking intention of chucking it into the nearest sewer or of doing aught else but deliver it. Civilization is one long, anxious search for just such individuals. Anything such a man asks will be granted. His kind is so rare that no employer can afford to let him go. He is wanted in every city, town, and village, in every office, shop, store, and factory. The world cries out for such. He is needed, and needed badly, the man who can carry a message to Garcia." New heading, The Trim Tab Spirit. You can see that no matter what issue, problem, or concern you have, you can empower yourself by taking initiative in some way. Be sensitive, be wise, be careful regarding time, but do something about the situation. Avoid complaining, criticizing, or being negative. Be especially wary of absolving yourself from responsibility and simply blaming them for failures. We live in a culture of blame. A full 70% of XQ respondents see that people in their organization tend to blame others when things go wrong. So taking responsibility will mean swimming against the cultural current. Taking initiative requires vision, some standard to be met, or some improvement to be achieved. It requires discipline in the doing. It requires getting your heart and your passion into it and doing it in a conscience-directed or principled way toward a worthy end. Tom Peters describes the trim tab attitude and spirit this way. Winners, no kidding, adore crummy jobs. Why? Because those jobs allow lots and lots of space. Nobody cares. Nobody is watching. You're on your own. You are king. You can get your hands dirty, make mistakes, take risks, perform miracles. The most common lament of the unempowered is that they don't have the space to do anything cool. To which I unfailingly reply, rubbish. Bottom line, relish the little assignment or chore that no one else wants. Seek it out. It's a license for self-empowerment. Whether it's the redesign of a form or planning a weekend client retreat, you can turn it into something grand and glorious and wow. Close quote. Once I served as the administrative assistant to the president of a university. In many ways, he was dictatorial, controlling, always assumed he knew what was best and would make all the important decisions. On the other hand, he was a visionary, a brilliant, talented person. But he treated everyone like a gopher. Go for this, go for that. As if they didn't have a mind. These highly educated, motivated men and women gradually became disenchanted and then disempowered. They would stand around the executive corridors complaining about the president. I can't believe what he did. You know, let me tell you the latest. Oh, you think that's bad. You ought to see what he did when he came into our department. Really? I'd never heard that. Yeah, I've been in a job where I've been so constricted and straitjacketed by all these foolish rules and this bureaucracy. It's bogging me down. You know, they'd spend hours massaging each other's hearts with such comments. Then there was Ben. He simply took another approach. He went straight to the third level of empowerment and initiative. Even though he, too, was treated like a gopher, he decided to start at the make-a-recommendation level. He decided to be the best gopher around. This earned him credibility, ethos. He would then anticipate the president's needs and the reasons behind the gopher requests, ethos. He would say inside himself, now let's see. Why does the president want this information? I'll bet he's preparing for a board meeting and he wants me to gather data on how many university campus securities around the country carry sidearms, because he's getting criticized about our approach. I think I'll help him prepare for that board meeting. Ben came to a preliminary meeting, presented his gopher data, then went the second mile in analysis and recommendations. The president turned to me, speechless. Then he turned back to Ben and said, I want you to come to the board meeting and make the recommendation. Your analysis is brilliant. You anticipated exactly what the need is. Everyone else on the staff had bought into the silent conspiracy of wait until told. But not Ben. He exercised the initiative by empathizing with the president, by determining what it was he really wanted and needed. Ben started out with a relatively low position, but pretty soon he was regularly making presentations to the board. Logos. His motto was, compliment. Don't criticize your boss. Compliment, P-L-E. Compliment your boss. I worked in that role for 4 years. By the end of the fourth year, Ben was the second most influential person on the campus, even though he hadn't risen through the academic ranks. The president would not make any significant moves without Ben's blessing. When Ben retired, there was a special recognition award put in his name. Why? Because he modeled trustworthiness, loyalty to the university, and the willingness to do whatever it took, and the exercise of initiative and self-empowerment. I think Ben understood the futility of wishing for something to be different. Can you see in this story how leadership can become a choice? Can you see how you, too, can become the leader of your boss, as Ben did? So when we say that leadership is a choice, it basically means you can choose the level of initiative you want to exercise in response to this question. What is the best I can do under the circumstances? You will always need to make judgment calls regarding these 7 levels of initiative. It takes judgment and wisdom to know what level of initiative to exercise, what you should do, how you should do it, when you should do it, and perhaps most importantly, why you should do it. This will take all 4 intelligences. The why question usually taps into spiritual intelligence because it gets at your value system, the source of motivation. The what to do question usually taps into your intellectual intelligence as you think analytically, strategically, and conceptually. The when to do it and how to do it questions usually tap into your emotional intelligence as you read the environment, sense the cultural and political operating norms, and discern your own strengths and weaknesses. The doing intelligence will also come into play as you carry out your intentions and tactically implement the how. When you wisely use initiative through all 7 levels of initiative, you'll find that your circle of influence will get larger and larger until it encompasses your entire job. Interestingly, and this almost always happens, as your circle of influence enlarges, so too does your circle of concern. A trim tab leader is constant, like a lighthouse, not a weather vane, a constant, dependable source of light, not someone who twists and turns with every social wind. As you take this inside-out, initiative-seizing approach, people in formal positions will have increasing confidence in your character and competence. Trust will increase. It is almost inevitable that they will want to build higher and higher levels of initiative and empowerment into your job. You will find yourself becoming the leader of your boss, and your boss will naturally become part of a complementary team as servant leader. Now let's see the film. This film is called Mauritius. You will find it on the companion DVD to the book. Not only organizations or individuals can be trim tabs, this film illustrates how an entire country or society could trim tab its own success and culture, in spite of profound ethnic, racial, cultural, and other differences. In fact, it is not in spite of, but simply because of the differences that they have produced such remarkable cultural strengths. The statements given at the beginning of the film were accurate as of the time of its production. Some conditions in Mauritius have changed, including increased pockets of social strife. But the real point of the story is not that Mauritius is a perfect society. It is that whatever challenges we may face, whether individually, as families, as organizations, or even as nations, we can work within our circle of influence and creatively trim tab our way through them. Here are 3 short questions that are commonly asked regarding the issues and the content contained in Chapter 7. Here is the first question. All this sounds good, but you don't know my boss. He is a control freak and is threatened by competent people around him. My situation is so different. My answer, yes, every situation is unique and different in some way. But in another sense, at bottom, challenges and problems are very similar. The key does not lie in the circumstance, it lies in the space between stimulus and response. That is, in the circumstances and your response to it. This is where your freedom to choose belongs. If you use this freedom wisely and base your choices on principles, not only will your freedom to choose increase in size, but you will also develop an internal source of personal security, so that your life will no longer be a function of the weaknesses of others. You will no longer disempower yourself and empower their weaknesses to continue to mess your life up. You may do a cost-benefit analysis and decide to do something different or go somewhere else. Or you may simply decide to rely on the pragmatics of the marketplace and trim tab a larger circle of influence until you become indispensable to and ultimately even the leader of your boss. You have to use all 4 intelligences so you can be both creative and inspired. You also need to work inside your own circle of influence, but outside your job. You need to exercise a great deal of initiative and volunteerism in understanding unmet needs and unsolved problems so that you can exercise the appropriate level of initiative. You also need to do your own job superbly so as to merit the confidence of others, surveying other fields while cultivating well your own. Remember, ethos or credibility first, pathos or empathy, second, and logos, logic, third. Another question. Realistically, how can a person become the leader of their boss? My answer is simple. Become a light, not a judge. Again, become a light, not a judge. In other words, be a model, not a critic. Go to work inside your own circle of influence so that your moral authority is developed and expanded and you have credibility. Then courageously take initiative to make good things happen. Empathize with your boss's world, concerns, purposes, and mindset. Empathize also with the culture and the market, and then take these initiatives. Remember again, no bad-mouthing. Be patient and persistent, and you will grow in influence. The pragmatics of results will convert the cynics. This is leadership, a choice, remember, not a position. Third and last question. You often say that it is easier to get forgiveness than permission. But then sometimes, if you do take a little initiative based on that idea, you get reprimanded severely or even fired. My response is, keep investing in your personal and professional development and in your power to produce solutions to problems, and you will always have a source of economic security. You see, your security does not come from your job or from the patronage of other people. It comes from your ability to meet needs and solve problems. Keep investing in those abilities, and you will have endless opportunities. Also, pick your battles very carefully. Don't take initiative that is way outside your circle of influence. Instead, work outside your job, but inside your circle of influence. Don't drown in puddles of unimportant things. Then take initiative in the form of well-thought-out, thorough analysis and recommendations, and you will inevitably find your circle of influence getting larger and larger. Chapter 8, The Voice of Trustworthiness, Modeling Character and Competence. Dwight David Eisenhower once said, "The supreme quality for leadership is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, no matter whether it is on a section gang, a football field, in an army, or in an office." Some time ago, I was asked to consult for a bank that was having a problem with employee morale. "I don't know what's wrong," bemoaned the young president. Bright and charismatic, he'd risen through the ranks only to see his institution faltering. Productivity and profits were down. He blamed his employees. "No matter what incentives I provide," he said, "they won't shake off this gloom and doom." He was right. The atmosphere seemed poisoned with suspicion and lack of trust. For 2 months I ran workshops, but nothing helped. I was stumped. "How can anyone trust what's happening here?" was a typical employee refrain, but no one would tell me the source of the distrust. Finally, in more casual conversations, the truth emerged. The boss, who was married, was having an affair with an employee, and everyone knew it. It was obvious now that the company's poor performance was caused by his conduct. But the greatest damage this man was doing was to himself. He was thinking only of his own gratification, disregarding long-term consequences. Moreover, he had violated a sacred trust with his wife. In a word, his failing was one of character. In fact, I believe that 90% of all leadership failures are character failures. Just as trust is the key to all relationships, so also is trust the glue of organizations. It is the cement that holds the bricks together. I have also learned that trust is the fruit of the trustworthiness of both people and organizations. Trust comes from three sources: the personal, the institutional, and the one person consciously choosing to give it to another. An act that leads me to feel your belief that I can add value. You give me trust and I return it. Trust then becomes a verb and a noun. When it is both a verb and a noun, it is something shared and reciprocated between people. That is the essence of how a person becomes the leader of their boss. They merit trust by giving it. Trust, the verb, comes from the potential trustworthiness of the one receiving the trust, and the clear trustworthiness of the one giving the trust. The fourth role, empowering, embodies making trust a verb. We've surveyed over 54,000 people and asked them to identify the essential qualities of a leader. Integrity was by far the number one response. In many settings today, it is out of vogue to speak in terms of character. It's becoming equated with soft, touchy-feely stuff or with someone's religion. Some people wonder if our inner values matter anymore. After all, hasn't our noted bank executive succeeded in every visible way despite his transgressions? This question demonstrates a quandary of our modern life. Many have come to believe that the only things we need for success are talent, energy, and personality. But history has taught us that over the long haul, who we are is more important than who we appear to be. As I did a review of literature and success literature going back to the founding of the United States in preparation for writing The Seven Habits, I found that during the first 150 years, the focus was almost exclusively on the importance of character and principles. As we moved into the Industrial Age and after World War I, the focus began to shift to personality, techniques, and technologies, what we could call the personality ethic. This trend is continuing, but I sense a counter-trend emerging as people experience the fruits of valueless organizational culture and of the many scandals that has dotted the landscape. More and more organizations are recognizing the need for trustworthiness, for character, for producing trust in the culture. More and more people are seeing the need to look deeply into their own souls, to sense how they themselves contribute to the problems, and to figure out exactly what they can do to contribute to the solution and to serve human needs. Another president, Theodore Roosevelt, put it this way: "Character, in the long run, is the decisive factor in the life of an individual and of nations alike." What became of the bank president who was intimately involved with an employee? When I confided to him what I knew of his affair and the effect it was having on his staff, he ran his fingers through his hair and said, "You know, I don't know where to begin." "Is it over?" I asked. He looked me squarely in the eye. "Yes, absolutely." "Then begin by talking with your wife," I answered. He told his wife, who forgave him. Then he called a meeting of his staff and addressed the morale problem. "I have found the cause of the problem," he said. "It is me. I am asking you to give me another chance." It took time, but eventually employee morale, a sense of openness, optimism, and trust improved. In the end, however, the executive was doing himself the greatest favor. He was finding his own path to character. New heading: personal trustworthiness. Wherever you find lasting trust, you will find trustworthiness. It is always so. It is a principle. Just as trust comes from trustworthiness, trustworthiness comes from both character and competence. When you develop both strong character and competence, the fruit is wisdom and judgment, the foundation of all great and lasting achievements and trust. Let's begin with the three facets of personal character: integrity, maturity, and the abundance mentality. Integrity means that you are integrated around principles and natural laws that ultimately govern the consequences of our behavior. Honesty is the principle of telling the truth. Integrity is keeping promises made to self and or others. Gandhi said, "A man cannot do right in one department of life while he is occupied in doing wrong in any other department. Life is one indivisible whole." Now let's look at maturity. Maturity develops when a person pays the price of integrity and winning the private victory over self, allowing him or her to be simultaneously courageous and kind. In other words, such a person can deal with tough issues compassionately. The combination of courage and kindness is both the source and the product of integrity. Now let's look at what we could call the abundance mentality. Abundance mentality means that rather than seeing life as a competition with only one winner, you see it as a cornucopia of ever-enlarging opportunity, resources, and wealth. You don't compare yourselves to others and can be genuinely happy for their successes. Scarcity-minded people come out of a comparison-based identity and are threatened by the successes of others. Even though they might pretend and say otherwise, they know it's eating their hearts out. Those with an abundance mentality see their competitors as some of their most valued and important teachers. These same three attributes, integrity, maturity, and abundance mentality, perfectly describe a complementary team. Now let's look at the competence side of personal trustworthiness. Technical competence is the skill and knowledge necessary to accomplish a particular task. Conceptual knowledge is being able to see the big picture, how all parts relate to one another. It's being able to think strategically and systemically, not just tactically. Interdependence is an awareness of the reality that all of life is connected, particularly with organizations and complementary teams that are attempting to win and keep the loyalty of customers, associates, suppliers, and owners. Independent thinking in an interdependent reality would be analogous to playing tennis with the golf club or thinking analog ideas in a digital world. As my son-in-law Matt was being interviewed for medical school, he was asked whom he would prefer. An honest surgeon who was incompetent, or a competent surgeon who was dishonest? He reflected and gave a very good answer. He said, "It all depends on the issue. If I needed the surgery, I'd go for the competent one. If it was a question of whether to have the surgery or not, I'd go for the honest one." Both character and competence are, of course, necessary, but they are also individually insufficient. General H. Norman Schwarzkopf put it this way, "I've met a lot of leaders in the Army who were very, very competent, but they didn't have character. For every job they did well in the Army, they sought reward in the form of promotions, in the form of rewards and decorations, in the form of getting ahead at the expense of somebody else, in the form of another piece of paper that awarded them another degree, a sure road to the top. You see, these were competent people, but they lacked character. I've also met a lot of leaders who had superb character, but who lacked competence. They weren't willing to pay the price of leadership, to go the extra mile, because that's what it took to be a great leader. To lead in the 21st century, you will be required to have both character and competence." Close quote. You will clearly discover, if it's not already obvious to you, why there is no way you can make significant progress in your relationships with other people if your own life is a mess, or if you're basically untrustworthy. That's why, in the last analysis, to improve any relationship, you must start with yourself. You must improve yourself. New heading. Modeling is living the 7 habits of highly effective people. The 7 habits of highly effective people embody the essence of becoming a balanced, integrated, powerful person and creating a complementary team based on mutual respect. They are the principles of personal character. The habits cannot be adequately covered here in a way that truly impacts. That is best experienced in the book, and particularly in teaching and living the book. But let's attempt a brief summary of the 7 habits. Habit 1, be proactive. Being proactive is more than taking initiative. It is recognizing that we are responsible for our own choices and have the freedom to choose based on principles and values rather than on moods or conditions. Proactive people are agents of change and choose not to be victims, to be reactive, or to blame others. Habit 2. Begin with the end in mind. Individuals, families, teams, and organizations shape their own future by first creating a mental vision for any project, large or small, personal or interpersonal. They don't just live day to day with no clear purpose in mind. They identify and commit themselves to the principles, relationships, and purposes that matter most to them. Habit 3. Put first things first. Putting first things first means organizing and executing around your most important priorities. Whatever the circumstance, it is living and being driven by the principles you value most, not by the urgent agendas and forces surrounding you. Habit 4. Think win-win. Thinking win-win is a frame of mind and heart that seeks mutual benefit and mutual respect in all interactions. It's thinking in terms of abundance and opportunity rather than scarcity and adversarial competition. It's not thinking selfishly, win-lose, or like a martyr, lose-win. It's thinking in terms of we, not me. Habit 5. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. When we listen with the intent to understand others, rather than with the intent to reply, we begin true communication and relationship building. Opportunities to then speak openly and to be understood come more naturally and easily. Seeking to understand takes consideration. Seeking to be understood takes courage. Effectiveness lies in balancing or blending the two. Always with the focus of understanding first. Habit 6. Synergize. Synergy is the third alternative, not my way, not your way, but a third way, our way, that is better than either of us would have come up individually. It's a form of creative cooperation. It's the fruit of respecting, valuing, and even celebrating one another's differences. It's about solving problems, seizing opportunities, and working out differences. It's the kind of creative cooperation where 1 + 1 = 3, or 11, or 111, or more. Synergy is also the key to any effective team or relationship. A synergistic team is a complementary team, where the team is organized so that the strengths of some compensate for the weaknesses of others. In this way, you optimize and run with strengths and make individual weaknesses irrelevant. Habit 7. Sharpening the saw is about constantly renewing ourselves in the four basic areas of life: body, mind, heart, and spirit. It's the habit that increases our capacity to live all of the other habits of effectiveness. The first three habits can be summarized in a very simple four-word expression: make and keep a promise. The ability to make a promise is proactivity, habit 1. The content of the promise is habit 2, and keeping the promise is habit 3. You might be interested to know that according to the XQ data, only 50% of the workers surveyed agree that their organizations consistently do what they say they will do. The next three complementary team habits can be summarized in a short phrase: involve people in the problem and work out the solution together. This necessitates mutual respect, habit 4, mutual understanding, habit 5, and creative cooperation, habit 6. Habit 7, sharpen the saw, is increasing your competency in the four areas of life: body, mind, heart, and spirit. It's renewing one's personal integrity and security. Those are habits 1, 2, and 3. And renewing the spirit and character of the complementary team. Those are habits 4, 5, and 6. So habit 7, sharpen the saw, renews the spirit and power of the other 6. These habits are all based upon principles that are universal and timeless. Principles I did not invent, but that are embodied in all enduring philosophy, psychology, and in all the major religions of the world. For habit 1, be proactive, the principle is responsibility and initiative. For habit 2, begin with the end in mind, the principle is vision and values. Habit 3, put first things first, is based on the principle of integrity and execution. Think win-win, habit 4, is the principle of mutual respect and benefit. Habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood, is based on the principle of mutual understanding. Habit 6, synergize, is based on the principle of creative cooperation. Habit 7, sharpen the saw, is the renewal principle. New heading, principles embodied in the 7 habits. Look carefully at each of these principles. As mentioned earlier, you'll notice 3 things. First, they are universal. That means they transcend culture and, as I mentioned, are embodied in all major world religions and enduring philosophies. Second, they are timeless. They never change. And third, they are self-evident. How do we know when something is self-evident? As mentioned before, by trying to argue against it. You simply can't do it. In the case of the principles underlying the 7 habits, you can't argue against the importance of responsibility or initiative, of having a purpose, of integrity, of mutual respect, of mutual understanding, of creative cooperation, or of the importance of continuous renewal. The 7 habits are character principles that shape who and what you are. They provide the credibility, moral authority, and skill base for your influence in an organization, including your family, community, and society. They are at the very core of the first of the 4 roles of leadership, modeling, or example. The 7 habits basically are what you are, and the 4 roles of leadership are what you do as a leader to inspire others to find their voice. Many organizations have trained their employees in the 7 habits. Many of these people have found the 7 habits to be very useful at work if the structures and systems support them. But because in many cases, low-trust cultures and misaligned structures and systems have not been supportive, many have concluded that the 7 habits don't really work at work. This 4-role model creates a compatible and supportive context for the 7 habits so that they can really be lived both at work and at home. In fact, we have found that this is the way people really learn the 7 habits, not as an intellectual exercise, but as an experiential exercise. It is only when people apply the 7 habits, that is, actually live them, that they come to really know them. To know them intellectually but not to do them is really not to know them. The 4 roles context will create an entirely new life for the 7 habits, and they will be perceived as strategically vital to an organization instead of just the nice sideshow training program. In other words, the 4 roles mainstream the 7 habits. I remember once training a very large group of top public and private sector executives in Egypt. They thought I came to sell the 7 habits. My opening comment was, "You think I've come here to sell the 7 habits. I'm telling you not to buy the 7 habits, because all you'll do is see it as a training program for others of lesser rank. You won't fundamentally alter your leadership style and reinvent the structures, systems, and processes that reinforce the principles in the 7 habits. Such changes require a new paradigm of leadership. That's what I've come to teach. If you want to be the leader of the Arab world, And to become current with the new economic global marketplace, you need a larger and supportive context for the seven habits. And you yourself need to get deeply involved in them. Then you will be totally astonished at the results you can achieve. Apparently, this intrigued them. At the break, they got on their cell phones and the audience doubled for the later sessions. New heading, Seven Habits Paradigms. Each one of the seven habits not only represents a principle, but also a paradigm, a way of thinking, a new map. When we more deeply consider that habits 1, 2, and 3 are represented in the four-word expression, make and keep promises, we come to understand the accompanying paradigm of each habit. Habit 1, be proactive, is a paradigm of self-determination, rather than genetic, social, psychic, or environmental determination. I can and will make a promise. It is the power of choice. Habit 2, begin with the end in mind, is the paradigm that all things are created twice, the mental, then the physical. It is the content of the promise. I can consider both the substance of the promise I want to make and what I hope to accomplish from it. It's the power of focus. Habit 3 is the paradigm of priority, action, and execution. I have the ability and responsibility to carry out that promise, to execute on my commitment. Habits 4, 5, and 6, think win-win, seek first to understand, then to be understood, and synergize, are the paradigms of abundance in dealing with others, abundance of respect, of mutual understanding, balancing consideration and courage, and also of valuing differences. It is at the heart of a complementary team. Synergy does not produce compromise, it produces something that is greater than the sum of the parts. Habit 7 is the paradigm of continuous improvement of the whole person. It stands for education, learning, and recommitment, what the Japanese called Kaizen. New heading, the modeling tool, the personal planning system. Because modeling always comes first and is manifest primarily in the other three roles, your first job is to get your act together, to create focus in your life. You simply have to decide what matters most to you. What are your highest values? What vision do you have for your life? What about your work at home as a father, mother, grandfather, grandmother, aunt, uncle, sister, brother, cousin, son, or daughter? What kind of service would you like to give your community, your church, your neighborhood, and others in need? How important is your health? How are you going to maintain and enhance your health? Some have said that health is wealth, and that without it, no other wealth matters. What about your mind, your growth and development? How important is that to you? What about your work? What are your true talents? Where does your passion lie? Where are the greatest needs in your organization and in the marketplace? On what projects and initiatives does your conscience inspire you to take action? How will you truly make a difference in your work? What will your legacy be? The focusing tool of the first role is a personal planning system. You begin by writing down, either in your paper planner or your electronic planning device, what matters most to you, and then building those governing priorities into your planning system so that you can effectively balance the need for structure and discipline with the need for spontaneity. In short, focus and execution. Even as or more powerful than visualization, writing bridges the conscious and the subconscious mind. Writing is a psychoneuromuscular activity and literally imprints the brain. To test this, before you go to bed, write down three things you want to do or think about first thing in the morning and just see what happens. In almost all cases, you will have a consciousness of those three things when you first wake up in the morning. But you know, many people do not take advantage of the powerful benefits of using a personal planning system. In fact, only 1/3 of the XQ respondents have one. There are many different approaches to developing and keeping a personal planning system. The key thing is that the method should work to keep the individual focused on his or her highest priorities. In other words, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Some, like myself, find that this kind of structure gives freedom, where others find it stifling. A powerful planning and organizing tool contains the following three criteria. It is integrated into your life and lifestyle. It is mobile, to always be accessible. And it is personalized, so it exactly suits your needs. There is a simple process for evaluating whether or not those things upon which you are focused are clearly aligned with what matters most to you. Envision, if you will, a productivity pyramid that looks like this. At the base, we first identify our mission and governing values, our standards and ideals. Elvis Presley once said, "Values are like fingerprints. Nobody's are the same, but you leave them all over everything you do." As we discussed earlier, these values should be anchored in principles so that your life will have a changeless core and an inner source of security, guidance, wisdom, and power. The key to this is perhaps writing a personal mission statement that describes what matters most to you, including your vision and values. Having this mission statement up front enables you to prioritize your life. A woman once came to me and said, "I've witnessed the process of my father dying. We were very close, and it was very emotional. I remember that you wrote in the Seven Habits book that one of the